Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. Layoffs and job losses hurt. They hurt entire families, and they can affect entire communities.
The suffering isn't isolated just to the coal industry, just to coal workers, because those coal workers are spending money at the local mall or the movie theater or the restaurant. So that's even less demand for those kind of support businesses.
Today on Inside Appalachia, we'll hear from people who worry about what our region will look like in 20 years if coal mines and coal-fired power plants continue to shut down.
I don't care if they shut all the mines down, if it brings us something in here to do.
Some people wonder if farming and agriculture could be one of the ways Appalachia transitions out of a coal economy.
So we're surrounded right now by potatoes, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, basil, sweet corn, popcorn, sunflowers, and that's just surrounding us in this first front half of the farm.
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome, Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Thanks for tuning in. You're one of a growing number of fans of Inside Appalachia. Thank you for telling your friends, and thank you for subscribing to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. Tough times have brought sweeping changes to the coal fields of Appalachia. You're probably well aware that here in southern West Virginia, it's really tough right now for coal miners, their families, and many communities. I know several former coal miners who are living out of state to find work to support their families left here in West Virginia. Some of them visit every couple months, while others spend a couple of weeks or a month away, then come back home for a limited time. So many miners have been laid off these last few years, and those who have a job don't have a lot of hope that they'll be able to keep what they have for much longer. William Lusk has lived in Wyoming County in southern West Virginia his whole life. He started working in coal mines about 23 years ago.
I guess just a product of your environment. I mean, there wasn't a lot else to do. So, you know, you either work for the state road or a school teacher or work in the mines. You know, a lot of choices.
Lusk and his family just last year endured 3 months of living without employment after he was laid off. He was able to find work at another underground mine that's 80 miles away, but things aren't looking good for that job either. His family says he was recently put on notice that he might lose his job in just a few weeks. Living with the uncertainty is brutal.
I don't know if it would ever get any better. What they need to concentrate on is, you know, if they want to do away with the company, just bring some other industry in here for us to do. I mean, I'll be 45. And if they had a Toyota plant close by or something, I mean, I don't expect to make miners' wages.
The federal government offers emergency grants to states that have significant job losses. Since 2012, millions of dollars have been provided to Kentucky and West Virginia through the National Emergency Grants. The money is meant to provide retraining for jobs in fields such as welding, electrical engineering, diesel technology, chemical processing, and commercial driving, just to name a few. But Lusk is skeptical about whether retraining is going to get him a job. Sure, there's the fracking boom, but that's happening in the northern part of the state. He says he doesn't see a lot of opportunities deep in the coal fields of southern West Virginia.
Well, I'm saying they want to send you to be a truck driver, or that's really not very good. What they need to do, instead of trying to retrain you to do something that you're going to have to leave the state, I mean, if you're a cross-country truck driver, I don't want to do that. That's not the kind of life I want to live. I'd way rather work in some kind of factory where I could maybe drive from here to Beckley or here to Princeton and go to work my shift and come home. I don't want to travel all. Maybe some people that may be fine, but I don't want to do that. And if they want to put up windmills, fine. I can put them together too, whatever they want us to do, but just do something. Mm-hmm. Just don't sit here and not do anything. But
that's William Lusk, a coal miner from West Virginia with almost 23 years of experience. We'll hear more from him in an upcoming episode, where we'll also hear from his daughter, Savannah, who is pursuing her college degree on a full-ride scholarship to West Virginia University. The program Mr. Lusk was talking about is meant to complement the Power Plus plan proposed in President Obama's 2016 budget. We'll hear more about that later. We'll also talk with farmers who are growing food for people in need and helping diversify Appalachia's economy at the same time. But first, let's get a better understanding of why. Why is the coal industry going into a seemingly crippling bust? Well, according to researchers, there are several factors at play. When you talk to folks in the coal fields, you always hear about Obama's clean power plan and how that's hurting the coal industry. The loss of coal jobs is more complicated than just one factor, but we'll start there. President Obama officially unveiled the Clean Power Plan in early August.
And today we're here to announce America's Clean Power Plan, a plan 2 years in the making and the single most important step America has ever taken in the fight against global climate change. The EPA is setting the first ever nationwide standards to end the limitless dumping of carbon pollution from power plants.
Obama warned that if nothing is done about climate change, it will threaten future generations. But the plan drew immediate flak from coal-producing states in Appalachia. Those states are suing the EPA, trying to prevent these regulations from going into effect because they say the plan will bring dire consequences to our region's economy. The Bureau of Business and Economic Research at West Virginia University has been watching the downturn of the coal industry for years. Beth Voorhees of West Virginia Public Broadcasting spoke with John Deskins, the Bureau's director, about what effects these regulations might have for the future of coal in West Virginia.
When this power plan was revealed, not only last year as it was proposed, but when it was revealed as being the rule, what did you immediately think of as somebody who looks at the state's economy at this news? What did you immediately think of?
Well, of course, my immediate reaction is there is no doubt this is going to be even more downward pressure on coal, and it's going to cause a lot more economic hardship for our state in addition to all the hardship we've already endured over the last several years.
But certainly in your economic crystal ball, as you have given the economic forecast to the state and to lawmakers, to the governor, you've seen this coming.
No, absolutely. My office just released a forecast for long-term coal production back in May. We actually took into account the proposed version of the Clean Power Plan, and we've already accounted for we provided a scenario that lays out what we expect to happen if the Clean Power Plan is introduced or implemented, if it's not implemented. So we've already been thinking about it a lot.
What do you expect?
Well, we think that coal, absent the Clean Power Plan, we think that coal is going to settle at somewhere between 95 and 100 million tons. And that's down already more than one-third from where it was just in 2007 or 2008. And if the Clean Power Plan is implemented according to the proposed rules, then we think it's going to fall additionally down to maybe around 80 million tons. So that's an additional 20% drop from where we are now, in addition to a tremendous drop already. Now, the plan that was released yesterday was a little bit more stringent than what was in the proposal, but it's still in the same ballpark.
Mm-hmm. What does it mean for jobs?
It means more losses in coal jobs, and those jobs are typically good-paying jobs. But the suffering isn't isolated just to the coal industry, just to coal workers, because those coal workers are spending money at the local mall or the movie theater or the restaurant. So that's even less demand for those kind of support businesses or related businesses in the community. So it's, even more hardship for West Virginia.
In his announcement that Alpha Natural Resources is filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, Alpha's president, Kevin Crutchfield, said, "We should not think of the coal industry in the past tense." And Governor Tomlin agreed with that statement. It is not in the past tense. Is it?
No, it's not. I mean, like I say, in our forecast, under our least optimistic scenario, we still thought coal production was going to be 80 million tons. And that's still a lot of coal, and that's still important to our economy. It's just we're basing this off of the benchmark that we saw the recent high in 2007 or 2008. But 80 million tons is still an important component of our economy. I mean, the bottom line is coal is still going to be used in electric power generation as part of the base load. That's going to be the case with the Clean Power Plan. Without, there's still going to be some coal out there. Coal is still going to be exported overseas. One of the really interesting parts of this picture is that coal demand is actually rising worldwide, especially in places like China and India, those very large, very rapidly growing economies, and we're fulfilling some of that worldwide demand. So we're still going to be exporting coal. And, of course, we still have industrial uses, right? We still have the uses for metallurgical coal in steel and other industries, and especially a lot of the production in southern West Virginia is that metallurgical coal. So it's still going to be there. It just looks bad compared to that 2007 benchmark.
How about the natural gas sector? How does that look?
Natural gas looks good in the long run. As you probably know, natural gas prices have fallen a lot in recent years, and they've been especially low over the last 6 months or so. And so production growth in West Virginia has really flattened out over the last 6 months. But the thing is, natural gas, we don't have the infrastructure in place to get natural gas to everywhere that it needs to be right now. And as we enhance this infrastructure to get natural gas out to where it needs to be, then we're going to continue to see more very healthy production growth over the longer term, even though there may be something of a slowing down over a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
But long term, very positive.
And when you say infrastructure, you mean the pipelines have been proposed.
I mean pipelines, and I also mean the process of liquefying natural gas to export it to Europe. Because as you know, in Europe, prices are probably four times as high as they are in America. So if we can enhance the technology and our ability to liquefy the natural gas to send it over to Europe, that's another big part of the long-term picture.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that the people seem to be very interested in when I talk around the state is the fact that coal is being hit by a perfect storm. It's not just the regulatory climate, right? I mean, we have at least three major factors that are hurting coal. One is the regulatory climate. That's a really important factor, and that deserves attention. But just the natural gas boom, naturally, in a basic free market economy, the natural gas boom is going to lead to some downward pressure on coal as natural gas gets so much more affordable. And we also have these very stringent geographic challenges in West Virginia, in southern West Virginia. Southern West Virginia coal is a lot deeper in the ground now, or what's left is a lot deeper in the ground, and it's harder to mine, it's harder to extract. We see lower productivity numbers in southern West Virginia. So southern West Virginia coal is at a cost disadvantage compared to northern West Virginia or Illinois mm-hmm. or Wyoming or Australia. All these things are coming together to hurt coal in West Virginia, not just the regulatory climate.
I don't want to go all political on you, but it will be a presidential election year in 2016. Mm-hmm. Let's just say a president is elected and this president wants to do away with this clean power plan completely, wants to ease regulations around coal mining.
Mm-hmm.
Would coal mining come back if that happened?
That's what I mean. We have a lot of downward pressure on coal, and it's not just the regulatory climate. If your scenario happened, it would help coal, that no doubt about it. But the cost disadvantages that we see from just geologic challenges in southern West Virginia, that's not going away because of some policy in Washington. Those challenges are there and they're permanent. We've seen these lower productivity numbers for close to a decade now. Has nothing to do with the regulatory climate. And also the natural gas boom and the incentive that a lot of electric generators have to switch to natural gas or at least to use natural gas for more of a peak load generation, that has nothing to do with the regulatory climate as well, or at the very least it has relatively little to do with the regulatory climate. So coal would come back to some extent under that scenario, but there's no way that would cause it to go back to 2008 levels. We have too many factors at play.
John Deskins, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. Great to be on.
That was John Deskins, the director of the Bureau of Business and Economic Research at West Virginia University, speaking with Beth Voorhees of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. As Deskins mentioned, many coal seams in southern West Virginia are becoming difficult to access. In 1995, the U.S. Bureau of Mines found that the depleted coal reserves in Boone County, West Virginia specifically, will be able to sustain mining activity for no more than 20 years. Here we are, more than 20 years later, some mines remain open, clawing the last bit of coal from the ground. As the price of coal has declined over the past 4 years, West Virginia may be feeling the financial impact more than any other state. In the country as a whole, employment is up. The Department of Labor is reporting the lowest unemployment rate since April 2008. But the state most left behind by the rise in employment is West Virginia, which is struggling with the highest unemployment rate in the nation. Ashton Marr of West Virginia Public Broadcasting zeroes in on how the decline of coal prices is affecting how West Virginia governments pay the bills.
The unincorporated town of Comfort, West Virginia, is made up of two gas stations and an elementary school. All three sit along a winding two-lane road that on any given day is peppered with trucks carrying loads of coal. Coal they picked up at the Kanaw Eagle Mining Complex a few hundred feet down the road. But the last several years have been tough for the industry, and now fewer and fewer of those trucks roll through.
Sometimes I wonder how they even make money.
31-year-old Derek Chase has worked in the industry for nearly a decade. He stopped at one of the Comfort gas stations about an hour before his night shift at the Canal Eagle site, where he works as an electrician.
We've been in bankruptcy for probably close to 2 months now.
Earlier this year, Chase's employer, Patriot Coal, filed for bankruptcy, and this month issued notices to some 1,000 employees in southern West Virginia that they could be laid off. But Chase's story isn't unique in Boone County, where he lives and works. The county has lost nearly 2,700 mining jobs since 2011, the highest number of coal job losses for any county in the nation. The decline hasn't just been bad news for miners like Chase, though. Coal is one way local governments in West Virginia pay for things like water lines and senior centers.
All your coal counties are really hurting, southern West Virginia. We're all the same.
Mickey Brown has been a member of the Boone County Commission for 15 years. Brown watched as his county's budget grew in the early part of the decade because of an influx of dollars from coal severance taxes. A severance tax is the rate companies pay for extracting a natural resource in the state. In West Virginia, mining companies pay 5% per ton of coal. But as the price of coal declined over the past several years, Commissioner Brown says so did the amount that Boone County collected. From 2012 to 2015, the county's budget was cut almost in half.
Now, we've made cuts all along to where we've been watching what we've been spending.
And those cuts have come to county services. Boone County prioritizes projects that will bring public drinking water to its rural communities. Instead of paying for it themselves with severance tax dollars, today the county relies on federal and private grants to fund waterline expansions. Those grants can be costly and time-consuming for small governments to apply for and keep track of. Community projects are suffering as well. Commissioner Brown says years ago, the County Board of Education asked for help replacing bleachers at all three county high school football stadiums, a $500,000 project. Today, if that project came before the commission, Brown says they'd have to turn them away.
Before, when somebody would come in with a request, it could be an extravagant request, and we could do it. But now we kind of made a policy that we're not going to do any more grants. $1,000 maximum each year.
And the state is starting to feel the pinch, too. Deputy Revenue Secretary Mark Muckhouse says back in 2012, coal mining tax revenues made up about 9% of the state's budget.
In the fiscal year 16 budget, we believe it's going to be closer to 5.4%.
Or a decrease of about $115 million. Federal regulations and an abundance of cheaper, cleaner natural gas is hurting the industry, Muckhouse says. He also attributes the decline to a decrease in foreign demand. Back in Boone County, where electrician Derek Chase lives, the decline in coal prices is forcing him out of not just the industry, but out of the state altogether. Chase, who has a wife and three young kids, started searching for a job long before his layoff notice came, and he found one outside of Albany, New York, some 650 miles away from home.
Got to work somewhere, and there's not going to be any place to work here.
Still, coal is following him. His new job with CSX would have had him working on locomotive engines, but it's been put on hold because of a decline in rail shipments of coal. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Ashton Mara in Comfort, West Virginia.
As we mentioned earlier, a lot of people in coal country blamed the Obama administration for the decline in coal jobs. And though some economists say the EPA isn't the main reason the coal industry is struggling, those same economists say new clean power regulations would bring long-lasting effects to our region. Earlier this year, the Obama administration announced that its proposed budget for 2016 would include $1 billion over the next 5 years to be allocated through the Abandoned Mine Lands Reclamation Program to areas with high unemployment. A lot of this money would go towards Appalachia. This funding is part of the Power Plus plan, which is different from the Clean Power plan, though both come from the Obama administration. In the Power Plus plan, the White House concedes that, quote, updated clean air standards are creating fewer opportunities for workers who live in coal mining communities. Some of the money would go towards economic job training for workers affected by layoffs at coal mines and coal-fired power plants. The spending, of course, would require congressional approval, and that deadline of October 1st is just weeks away. Some critics of the Power Plus plan argue that the amount of funding for struggling coal communities is just not enough to combat the tide of so much job loss. Bill Rainey, president of the West Virginia Coal Association, had this to say in reaction to the Power Plus plan. If you really want to help West Virginians and Kentuckians and Southwestern Virginians and all the others across the coal fields of this country, you wouldn't just throw us some table scraps. You would get out of the way and help us put our miners back to work. But not everyone in the coal fields agrees with Bill Rainey. Kentucky Public News Service's Greg Stottlemyre reports that there are a growing number of communities in Kentucky who have spoken out in favor of the Power Plus plan.
Support for the Obama administration's plan to revitalize Appalachian communities suffering from the loss of coal mining jobs is picking up steam in Kentucky. The city councils in Whitesburg and Benham have unanimously passed resolutions supporting the Power Plus plan. Eric Dixon with the Appalachian Citizens Law Center says eastern Kentucky towns need programs and funding to restart their economies.
The Power Plus plan isn't the end-all, be-all solution, but it is a very big step in the right direction.
The plan would pump hundreds of millions of dollars into job retraining, cleaning up abandoned strip mines, and shoring up health care and pensions for retired miners. When President Obama rolled out his plan for cutting carbon pollution, he said the claims of a war on coal are a way to scare up votes. The president said he wants to work with Congress to help communities and, as he put it, not use them as a political football. Tom Sexton, a former Whitesburg City Council member who is now a community organizer for the Sierra Club, says he believes support for transitioning away from coal is gaining momentum.
We're reeling down here. Whatever your politics are, but there's no wrong reason to bring $1 billion to create jobs for the region.
The Power Plus plan would put $1 billion from the Abandoned Mine Land Fund into cleaning up abandoned mines. There are 62 sites in Letcher County alone, where Whitesburg is the county seat. Dixon says it's the most consequential piece of the Obama administration's plan because it would create long-term economic opportunities.
It will immediately create jobs in the region, putting people to work, actually reclaiming these sites. And, you know, laid-off miners and others have the skills to do this sort of reclamation work.
After cleanup, Dixon says communities will then be able to transition the former strip mine sites into agriculture, recreational tourism, or energy jobs. I'm Greg Stottlemyre reporting for Public News Service.
Some of the funding from the Power Plus plan would go towards educating Appalachians with new skills that might help them find careers in the tech and digital industry. But some of the money would also go towards creating more job opportunities in older traditional industries like manufacturing and agriculture. Farming looks promising for some Appalachians who are looking for a way to survive without leaving for the big cities. But farming has its own challenges, the main being that it's really tough to make a living as a small farmer these days. Similar to the way that technology and machines change the coal mining business, with farming, bigger and bigger farms with more sophisticated technologies have replaced thousands of blue-collar jobs. During the 1970s and 80s, America lost millions of family farms. Agriculture was specializing and getting bigger, large dairies and croplands. Monocultures of corn and soybeans were basically pushing small farmers out of business. But in the last few years, the local food movement has begun to create more demand for smaller local farms. Lately, more women have been drawn to this evolving world of growing food. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant takes a closer look at the challenging role of women in farming.
Gwen Volkert and her husband milk about 50 goats every morning and every evening at their farm in northeast Ohio. They've trained them to hop up on a wooden milking stand. While the goat eats, they attach tubes to its backside and turn on the milking machine. Volkert is a computer sciences professor. She says they've been working on this goat cheese operation for the past 10 years, ever since a work trip brought them to Paris for a night.
Of course, the only thing I wanted to do was eat cheese.
They did, and it was so much better than what she could get in Ohio then.
And I simply stated as a fact that I'm going to make goat cheese. So, and then my husband said, I think you'll need some goats for that. And I go, well, that settles it. We need to get goats.
Some of her friends call her crazy for starting the farm.
But my husband and I have our standard line, which is very true, is you've got to have a hobby. And this is our hobby, and it is now turned into something that's even bigger than that.
Volkert is part of a trend of women who aren't necessarily farming to make a living. They want to provide better food for their families and communities. The USDA says most women-owned farms have sales of less than $10,000 a year, and they account for only 3% of total U.S. sales. But there are also many women who want farming as a full-time career. Researcher Carolyn Sachs says many cringe when they're called hobby farmers.
Women are really furious when you say that it's their, I mean, they're oftentimes not taken seriously as farmers. That they're thinking, oh, it's just their hobby. They're just doing this, you know, for fun. They are just doing it for something to do.
Sachs is a professor of women's studies at Penn State University and has written three books about women in agriculture, talking with women in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and elsewhere.
All of our women farmers say, are you kidding me? This is the hardest work I've ever done. You know, why would I do this if it was just, you know, if it was just for fun? I'm trying to make a living.
Women farmers have reason to be prickly about it. Until 2002, the USDA didn't even count most of them as farmers. The farm census had space to list one operator. On family farms, that usually meant only the husband was counted. Women were largely invisible. The USDA finds that farms that are run by women tend to be smaller, with less acreage and those lower sales. Carolyn Sachs says there are many reasons the numbers are so low. For one, even women who grow up on larger farms don't usually get ownership.
Many farms are still inherited from father to son. It still works that way, this patriarchal land inheritance systems.
While some of those male-dominated farms have grown into huge monocultures, others have shut down. Sachs says this is where women have found an important role, helping smaller and mid-sized farms transition in a changing economy.
A lot of these women, even if they've grown up on farms, aren't tied so much into this particular sort of masculine role of success, of getting larger, getting the biggest equipment you can, you know, farming as much acreage as you can, that they don't have that as part of their identities. So it's not as much of a risk for them to try new things.
Sachs gives the example of a Pennsylvania woman who led her father and husband to transition a failing dairy into a mixed beef and vegetable farm near Harrisburg. But she says there are other reasons many women run smaller farms.
I don't want to be essentialist in this, but they tend to be engaged in agriculture that doesn't use large-scale equipment.
Sachs says even many women who grew up on farms never learned how to maneuver or repair tractors, hay wagons, or other farm equipment. That's not stopping some in the younger generation. 26-year-old Beth Lomsky manages a 2-acre demonstration farm near downtown Cleveland, owned by a nonprofit organization. It's along the side of a busy road in the midst of vacant lots and old factories. Under her direction, teenage farm workers sit in the shade and clean garlic.
So we're surrounded right now by potatoes. We have about 800 row feet of potatoes, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, basil, sweet corn, popcorn, sunflowers, and that's just surrounding us in this first front half of the farm.
Lomsky grew up in the country of southwest Ohio, surrounded by huge corn and soybean fields. As a kid, this was her view of farming, and she didn't like it, the chemicals, the landscape. She never joined Future Farmers of America.
I was actually pretty anti-FFA, like the whole conventional agriculture, the culture around that.
But in college, she started learning about different kinds of farms that didn't use chemicals and grew a variety of fruits and vegetables.
As soon as I started getting into the small organic farms, the picture started to make sense. Small diversified farms, taking care of the soil and the land, and an emphasis on community and people, feeding people. So for sure, even from the beginning, I knew it was the right way to go.
Now Lomsky is part of the new wave of farmers, selling direct to customers at farmers markets. But she's not in this just for fun. This is her career.
There's definitely this myth that you cannot make a living from the land, and sustainable agriculture is fun and it's a hobby, but you'll never pay the bills. But that's totally, totally false.
Lomsky is gaining experience running the demonstration farm, and she plans to break out on her own. She hopes to start an orchard with apples, pears, cherries, and she doesn't see how it's any different from a man getting into the business. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
When we come back, we'll hear about a new mobile farmers market that takes its produce on the road. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education and more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We wanted to share a few comments that were posted on Facebook last week after our episode that focused on the many different views surrounding what it means to be gay in Appalachia. By the way, I'm sure you've already heard that county clerk in Rowan County was released from jail. At this time, she still has her job as a county clerk, and she still does not have to issue marriage licenses. Her deputies are issuing licenses. Dozens of you responded to our show on Facebook. Valerie Matthews wrote, "Gay marriage is totally against God. Read the Bible. It's in there. May God have mercy on their souls." Michael Adkins said, "Out of all the problems we have in Appalachia, y'all come up with this. My family has been here for 9 generations, and we still live on the same land. This is sad, and I now hang my head in shame, as these people are not true Appalachian Americans." John Nelson responded to Michael with this comment, "My family has been here for as many generations back as anyone can remember. Boone County born and raised right here. I'm also gay. So we exist. We didn't all just come from somewhere else." Tommy Summerfield also wrote, "My family has been in Appalachia for almost 300 years. I am a hillbilly, an educated hillbilly that loves people even if they're gay. Some of the nicest folks I know are gay, and guess what? They have grown up in these mountains the same way I did." Those are just a few of the comments on our Facebook page in response to last week's episode of Inside Appalachia. We heard from a number of people who chimed in on why they feel the acceptance of gay marriage has been mixed here in Appalachia. So what do you think? Are attitudes changing where you live? Is it hard to be gay in Appalachia? You can find this conversation on our Facebook page, West Virginia Public Broadcasting, or send us a message on Twitter, @InAppalachia. And don't worry, if you missed last week's episode or any of our past shows, Inside Appalachia is available for free as a podcast. Use your smartphone or your computer to search for Inside Appalachia on iTunes or Stitcher. We've also posted a link on our website, wvpublic.org. On our show today, we're talking about what's on the mind of a lot of folks in the coalfields these days. Finances, jobs, hopes, dreams. Is it possible for communities to transition out of coal and into new industries? What shape could a new Appalachia economy take in, say, 20 years? Could farming be an option? As more restaurant chefs and consumers are interested in having access to local foods, small-scale farming does seem like a great way to earn a bit of extra income for people. Farming is tough, and making an actual living at it is really a struggle. And it seems as though every few years there's some new challenge. For example, these days farmers are worried that honeybees won't always be around to help pollinate fruits and vegetables. Scientists believe bees are facing a perfect storm. There aren't enough flowers to provide bees with pollen and nectar to eat, as more land is planted with crops or covered with roads and buildings. At the same time, bees have to deal with pesticides, diseases, and parasites. But now researchers and backyard beekeepers are teaming up to build a better honeybee. The Allegheny Front's Lou Bluen has more.
Beekeepers have plenty of tough days, but this is a good day.
My mouths are full. We're eating honey that is fresh from the hive, and it's so delicious.
That's Pittsburgh beekeeper Steve Rapaski, and he actually hasn't been around to check on this particular hive in about a month. And now the bees have built a crazy, jagged, mini mountain range of foot-tall honeycomb inside an empty bee box.
The good news is it's what we call fresh cut-comb honey, but it's what we call a major screw-up by a beekeeper that should have put frames in there a month ago.
As far as screw-ups go, it's not really a big deal, but beekeepers aren't really allowed a whole lot of real screw-ups. And not because of colony collapse disorder. Scientists actually don't really see much of that these days. Bee researcher Marianne Fraser says the main thing that's been wiping out honeybees since the 1990s is actually a parasite called the varroa mite.
It's a parasitic mite that feeds on blood of adult bees and on the brood.
And it's basically like having a 6-pound house cat attached to your side, sucking the life out of you. Treatments for these mites were and still are pretty limited. Get this, we actually spray bees, which are of course insects, with insecticides. The hope is we'll kill the mites, but not the bees. The approach has worked well enough to at least give colonies a fighting chance, but out on a farm in western Pennsylvania, beekeepers are trying a new approach.
Let's go light a smoker here and we'll look at some bees.
This is commercial bee breeder Jeff Berta. He's part of a co-op of about 100 beekeepers stretching from Michigan to Tennessee. It's trying to build a better honeybee.
Number 18, she is there. That little disc there with the 18 on it. We call those our NASCAR bees there because they have numbers on them.
Number 18 is one of Berta's all-star queen bees. She's also a bit of a science experiment. This queen's mother is from a Vermont colony that survived disease and cold winters. And then Berta had her artificially inseminated by Purdue University scientists who developed bees with natural resistance to mites.
The bees will take the mite and they will bite the legs and they will chew on the mite. And if they bite a leg off of the mite will bleed to death. So the bees are actually fighting back. That's the type of genetic line that we're after right now.
So now, with every egg number 18 lays, she passes on those leg-biting behaviors, making a colony that can rid itself of mites naturally, with no help from pesticides. It's a huge breakthrough. But the breeding project can't end there. Because Berta can't artificially inseminate every queen, any descendants of number 18 that turn into queens themselves will likely just fly off and mate with any old drones within a few miles. Meaning, if Berta's beekeeping neighbors don't have strong bees too, they can easily dilute his carefully selected lines. Bee geneticist Christina Grosinger says you have to be in it for the long haul.
So you can't sort of produce a stock and say, now I'm done. And that was it. Now we could just sell it everywhere. You have to constantly reselect, and you constantly have to have people very interested in working as part of this effort.
That's why Jeff Berta and the co-op of beekeepers happily give eggs away from their best colonies to neighbors and swap queens to try out new genetics. It's all part of shifting the paradigm from a system where beekeepers simply buy new bees every year to a lasting neighborhood of bees that can slowly create real survivors. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Lou Bluin.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on the environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. You're Inside Appalachia. It's time for What's in a Name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. So many times on this segment, it seems like we hear about a town that got its name from some type of miscommunication. And it seems that's the case with True West Virginia as well. Have any guesses about where True may have gotten its name? This one stumped me, but I bet you've got some creative ideas. Send us a tweet if you want to take a quick stab at it, @InAppalachia. We'll have the answer after the break. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. So, how did True West Virginia get its name? Was it when the local postmaster declared his feelings for his true love? Or did it start when the sheriff arrested himself for a crime, all because he couldn't tell a lie? Yeah, wouldn't that be a story? But yeah, no, that's not it either. Actually, the true story of True isn't very romantic or epic. It was simply a case of a misunderstanding. For help with this one, we called up our friend Ken Sullivan, director of the West Virginia Humanities Council.
Well, as I said, names often arise organically. They'll be named just for a feature of a place it's just a natural use that people come to. But other names are deliberate, and it's in those deliberate names where people will make up a name that you get the interesting stories. There's a town in Summers County, I think it's Summers County, True, down by Summers, Mercer County line near Pipestem. And the story there is that when the fellows rode off to request a post office, they concluded their letter by saying, "We need a post office. That's true." And the postmaster general in Washington, when he got the letter, he thought that they meant that they need a post office named True, and to this day the place is called True. Now that story is almost too, you have to suspect a story like that.
We also found an explanation on Wikipedia that said the letter to petition a post office concluded with the line, "Now this is true." So I wonder what else was in that letter that might have not been true. I can see how that might have been misunderstood, but I can also see what the townspeople were trying to say. We need a post office. True to be, Holmes. Some of these stories almost raise more questions than when you started. Thanks to Ken Sullivan for helping us out with the mystery behind the town of True, West Virginia. If you have another story about True, West Virginia, or if you know of another place in Appalachia with an interesting sound or mysterious folklore behind it, send us a tweet at InAppalachia, hashtag What's in a Name. One of our Twitter followers, Allison Reif, recently reached out this way and suggested a town called Spankham Branch, Kentucky. Do you have the story behind this town? That's Spankham Branch, Kentucky. We hope to find the answer for another segment of What's in a Name. Today we've been hearing about some ways that Appalachia is trying to reinvent itself as the coal economy declines. The Obama administration's Power Plus plan calls for trying to turn some parts of coal country into farm country. But making a go of farming is a challenge, too. Some people in Appalachia are finding innovative ways to use locally grown farm products and even some surprising ways to use farm animals. Once again, here's the Allegheny Front's Lou Bluen, who caught up with some green entrepreneurs in Pittsburgh.
Calling Deirdre Price's new backyard a yard might just be a little bit generous.
So we basically got 5 lots, 3.5 are a hillside that is completely covered with bramble and brush and poison ivy and stuff like that.
And that's not an uncommon thing in Pittsburgh. Look around and you'll see hundreds of skinny homes stacked on hillsides like candles on a tiered birthday cake. The big lot, though, which is about 1/4 acre in all, is a big reason Deirdre bought the house. Clearing the yard, though, and turning it into something worthy of the name, for that she had to call on a special breed of landscaper.
Goats, goats, goats! Goats, goats, goats!
This is Carrie Pavlik, and she's out here today with her co-workers, which include 9 goats, her husband Doug, and, oh yeah, a guard donkey.
Hobo! The donkey's name is Hobo.
So here's how any of this makes any sense. Carrie and Doug recently started a goat landscaping business, which basically means they use goats to clear overgrown properties like Deirdre's. So about 1 week ago, Doug set up a temporary electric fence around Deirdre's property. They brought over the goats and the donkey.
The donkey is a livestock guardian. If a coyote were to breach the fence, he would chase them off.
Okay, and then they pretty much just let the goats do what goats do, which is, in this case, to eat their way through the wilderness of Deirdre's backyard.
Goats can go places that human landscapers and machinery can't, like steep slopes or tight spaces. They don't care about itchy or thorny plants like poison ivy or blackberry or other thorns. They actually really like those plants.
And Doug says in about 2 weeks, they'll have cleared this entire 1/4 acre.
Yeah, I mean, goats are, I think, particularly advantageous for parcels that maybe fall in between like what's easy for a homeowner to do and what's easy for a brush hog to do.
Using goats rather than heavy machinery like brush hogs has other benefits too. For one, goats are a lot quieter and don't disturb neighbors, despite all those screaming goat YouTube videos you may have seen.
We think it's fake, but we're not sure. I mean, we've never heard a goat scream like that.
And goats are also greener. They don't run on gasoline, and they can quickly chew through stubborn plants that would usually require spraying herbicides. Goats are so tenacious, in fact, they even get at roots and seeds, so unwanted plants don't come back. And the only collateral damage to speak of from having a herd roam your property actually has a silver lining.
So the goat poop, you won't really see that around because it's very small, it's dry, it's just great fertilizer, we leave it.
I'd say that goat poop is the most pleasant of the poops.
Money-wise, the goats aren't cheap. Deirdre is renting Carrie and Doug's for about 2 weeks for $10 a day per goat, plus another $10 a day for Hobo the donkey, plus a setup fee for the electric fence. All told, it's gonna cost her about $1,500. Deirdre admits she didn't even call around to get quotes from other landscapers. She wanted the goats out here mostly because she thought they were cool. And she says the neighborhood's been digging them too.
The kid up the street has pretty well convinced his mother, who's pretty well convinced his father, to get goats.
In fact, the neighborhood at large may be catching goat fever. Bob Steele, one of Deirdre's neighbors, has been watching the goats from next door. He says his lawn is begging for a small herd.
I stare longingly over the fence, saying I wish they were mine.
I'm hoping. You're talking to the person who has to mow 3/4 of an acre and it's on a hill.
Bob could get his wish and get some help with that hill. The city of Pittsburgh recently revised its livestock ordinance to clear the way for homeowners to keep goats, much like people keep backyard chickens now. And for Carrie and Doug, business is booming. They're already booked up through the fall and hope to double the size of their landscaping herd and hire an employee next year. There are certainly enough overgrown hillsides in Pittsburgh to keep the herd going for a while. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Lou Bluin.
When we started our show today, we heard about how the decline in coal is hurting communities. One big side effect from the decline of the coal industry is that grocery stores can't make as much money, and so they close down, leaving whole counties without many options. Appalachian food deserts exist when people have to drive more than a half an hour, and often they drive even further just to buy groceries. The result is that many people just buy fast food or whatever's available at their local gas station. Up next, we've got a story that makes our region look pretty resourceful. And hey, isn't that one of the things we Appalachians are pretty fantastic at? Mobile food markets are basically farmers' markets on wheels that move from place to place so the farmers can deliver to more people. Mobile markets exist in rural West Virginia. Now, a new program's just started up in Somerset, Pennsylvania, connecting local farmers with people who don't have good access to healthy food. The Allegheny Front's Kara Hulsoppel reports.
A line of people carrying laundry baskets and empty shopping bags curls around a brick church building. We're in the parking lot in rural Somerset County, southeast of Pittsburgh. This is farm country, but a lot of people here don't have access to fresh produce.
Good morning, Joetta. How are you?
Not bad. How about you today?
Not bad. The sun's out.
Joetta Shoemaker has placed her laundry basket on a shopping cart, and she weaves her way through folding tables. At one, she picks up boxes of mac and cheese. At the next, cucumbers.
Too heavy?
She pushes back her long gray braids as a volunteer places a bag of oranges into the basket.
What have been some of the favorite items that you've gotten here?
The peppers, the cabbage. I love stuffed cabbage and I love stuffed peppers.
Shoemaker's older and has medical issues, and she's got a young grandson to help raise at home. The family has some money coming in, but it's not enough to cover the healthy food they need.
I have come ever since I started. It really helps out a lot.
A few years ago, the Greater Pittsburgh Community Food Bank partnered with the Somerset County Mobile Food Bank to get food all the way out here, more than 60 miles from the city. Shoemaker gestures to the people behind her.
They're hardworking men and women here in this line that think, okay, this may be my only shot at having fresh produce.
Once everyone in line picks up their groceries, the mobile food pantry packs up and heads to the next tiny town. Over the next 3 days, it'll make 10 stops around Somerset County. Reverend Barry Rittenauer pushed to get fresh food out here. He says this region has a rich industrial and farming history.
But it's also a huge amount of poverty.
Pastor Barry, that's what everyone calls him, spends a lot of time in his car, following the mobile food pantry from site to site. He wants to make sure things go smoothly. When money's tight, Walmart and other stores are just too far for some people.
They got 20 miles to drive to go grocery shopping. Well, it's not cost-effective for them, so they don't go.
Instead of driving into the town of Somerset, people rely on dollar stores or convenience marts, not usually the best places for healthy food.
We're trying to figure out, do we figure out a way to bring the people into Somerset, or do we figure out how to take the food to the people?
So they started a mobile food pantry. They wanted to bring the food to the people. But with so many remote communities in need, it would take a few days to make all the stops. How to keep all that produce cold? That's where farmer Ken Saldano comes in.
This bay's refrigerated.
Saldano takes me through the farm's warehouse. It's a plain beige building with lots of shelving and 3 cavernous storage rooms, one's for cold storage.
Those are apples, oranges, potatoes, cabbage.
Of course, Saldano doesn't grow the oranges. He and his family grow green beans and potatoes and other vegetables. For a few delivery days each month, Saldano also becomes a middleman between the Pittsburgh Food Bank and Somerset County's traveling pantry. The week I visited, the Pittsburgh truck brought nearly 50 pallets of food.
It started little, but it got pretty big.
The mobile food pantry reaches 1,400 families now, but thousands more are food insecure here. The program is expanding into neighboring Cambria County. The Pittsburgh Food Bank doesn't want to truck all of that food from the city.
Plans are in the works to round up as much locally grown produce as they can store and distribute to people here in Somerset and surrounding counties. They also want to complete the circle, unloading the Pittsburgh Food Bank truck at the farm and sending it back to the city, full of Somerset-grown veggies. The whole project has been a lot of unexpected work for Soldano, but he says it makes him feel good to help his neighbors.
I know when I grew up, it was pretty tough. You know, you appreciate something like this.
The Pittsburgh Food Bank hopes farmers in other counties will feel the same. The area they serve needs 59 million additional meals a year. That's more than three times what they're providing now. And they're looking to farm country to help solve its own hunger problems, not just by growing food, but by finding new uses for farms, creating spaces close to home so people have what they need for those stuffed peppers. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Carol Holsapel.
It's just about harvest time when most farmers' markets are selling their end-of-summer produce and moving into fall foods. So we've posted some links to the mobile markets in West Virginia and the one in Somerset, Pennsylvania, and to some other farmers' markets across Appalachia. By the way, do you have a really great pumpkin pie or apple pie recipe? Send it to us, and we might feature it on our fall installment of Appetite Appalachia. It's our ongoing segment that features food and chefs from across Appalachia. That's our show today. We want to know what you think. Do you think that farming is an industry that could help Appalachia's economy? Or is local food just a trend that will pass? Is it really enough to support an economy? Hey, and what kind of businesses would you like to see come to Appalachia? And show us where you think that business could go. Does your town have a gorgeous old empty theater just waiting for someone to come fix it up? Send us a picture at In Appalachia and tell us what kind of new business you'd like to see move into your town. Or tell us what you'd build for Appalachia's future if you got a hold of any of that Obama Power Plus grant money. These are tough questions, but just because it's hard doesn't mean it's impossible. Maybe you could have the next big idea for Appalachia.
Great history is winding down in this region and in this town. The smoke is cleared and silence falls as the buildings tumble down. And as the rivers wash the banks of time, set our sons and daughters free. As these children roam, let them not forget this land is home to me. May its lessons be our foundation in this new age of transformation. For our fathers and mothers who settled here to build and feed a nation. In this country of lasting freedom, nothing less their legacy. Taught me to pray, lest I forget, this land is home to me.
Special thanks to the Allegheny Front in Pittsburgh and the West Virginia Humanities Council for helping us with our show this week. Music in today's show is also provided by Ben Townsend, Little Sparrow, Jake Sheps, and Tom Briding. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their album Songs of a Tradition. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Catherine Winter. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education and more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.